to Beach Haven, and then years later we started to go to, when the younger two girls went to, the older children went to camp in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania. Camp Ohelo and Camp Comet. The younger children went to camp in Maine to Forest Acres and Indian Acres. When they went to Maine, Seymour and I, of course, went to visit. And that's how we were introduced to New England and fell in love with New England. And we started to go to Cape Cod. And we, from that time until present, we've gone to Wellfleet on Cape Cod for vacations.
Well.
Wellfleet, one word. Massachusetts. Those were some of the vacations.
Have your children...
Oh, wait a minute. You asked me something else. What else we did together as a family?
Yes.
We always had company for dinner. And Friday night dinner was always very important. No matter how long I was working, and when I was working at Carnegie Mellon, it wasn't part-time, it was full-time. I wasn't tenure track, but I was working full-time. And when I'd finished teaching, I would pick up my mother, who lived on Bayard. By that time, she was a widow. And we would drive through all the parkway traffic to our home in Churchill. And there was always somehow or other, I had a lot more energy in those days, there was always a wonderful dinner, and frequently other people for dinner too. But I sort of alternated roast beef, brisket, chicken on for Friday nights.
Sort of guests did you invite? Were they
lots of college,
from university?
College students, lots of college students. Not lots of, but I had a daughter from Chatham 1 year, and I always had, there were always college students.
Were your children as a family involved with any of the religious life in the community or with the temple?
Well, they all went to Sunday school, and it was still before Rhoda Shalom had bar mitzvah. Norman was bar mitzvah, Beth Shalom. And I don't think they were very involved at all, except at home. I mean, at home and at their grandparents. The grandparents Krauss were very religious. And, that's what I meant to tell you about family events. My mother-in-law and father-in-law were very observant, and we went to their home frequently when the children were young, and they were still well for holidays. The Azans, the late 50s, have had a family Seder out. We had a very big family there when they were living. There were 11 brothers and sisters and all the children and the grandchildren. So we had some very wonderful family Seders. I think the largest one's about 70-some people. Now we're down to like 25.
Are you still continuing those families?
Oh, yes.
Families?
Mm-hmm.
And
we went to many places, but I remember particularly Mickey's Steakhouse on Forbes Avenue. He had the room upstairs. I think that's about the earliest that I remember. And then we both Webster Hall, and then we searching for places. Now we go to Concordia Club, but we went to the Park Shenley, and we went.
Well, in the days when the parents or grandparents were alive, did you have to choose places that were kosher?
The Krauss grandparents didn't come to them. This was the Azan Seder. The Seder's out were the Azan family, and nobody was kosher. The Seders at my in-laws, of course, were kosher. They were not from the way the Orthodox are today. I thought they were very Orthodox, and they certainly were very observant and very caring. However, they My mother-in-law cared more about pleasing everybody than about anything else. She wanted to make everybody happy. And my grandfather preferred, my father-in-law preferred his main meal at noon and a light milk supper. So, and my brother-in-law Dan, who lived at home, was an attorney downtown, so he came home hungry at night for a wonderful meal. So this isn't every night, but my mother-in-law made whatever anybody wanted. There would be nights when she would make 7 different meals, because there were her married daughter and son-in-law and grandchildren lived with her too. It's a big household. 4 of them, Dan and she and my father-in-law. And I would say that there were just almost as many meals. And what she would do if my father-in-law was having a milk soup and then was having a steak, she would have 2 tablecloths. And one half of the table would be flesh and one half of the table would be milk.
That's a wonderful story.
She was a wonderful. Well, they were wonderful. Seymour's parents were great. Really great. Yeah. Loving, wonderful.
During all of this time, you were still in a neighborhood that was essentially Jewish.
No. I lived in Churchill from the time of children. Yeah, our street had a lot of Jewish people, but it wasn't a Jewish neighborhood.
And did you find it easy to get along and have your family grow in a mixed neighborhood? That
was
never a problem.
It was never. There were plenty of Jewish people. If the children had any problems, then you'd have to ask them, because, see, I grew up in a totally Jewish neighborhood. They grew up in a mixed neighborhood.
All right. You were influenced during the Hitler period by your feelings about how Jews had been treated. How has this changed, and your feelings about anti-Semitism, how has that changed?
It hasn't changed at all. It's just developed. I mean, I just know more and understand more, but I never lost my interest, and I still find that I'm in the midst of a book now that I can't put down, and everybody's talking about all the wonderful novels, and meanwhile I'm slowly savoring this book called The Boys by Martin Gilbert, which is about story of the 742 teenage concentration camp survivors who were transferred after the war to England and eventually settled all over the world. And they've had 5-year reunions. They formed a group called themselves the Boys, although there are some girls that are part of them. And they had Martin Gilbert, who was the biographer of Winston Churchill, write their story. And it's just, I mean, I'm just fascinated with it. I'm reading it so slowly because I keep going back and rereading passages. And so I've never lost my interest in that, and nor in history. And that's all part of the same thing.
Has any of this involvement in history that you've been very involved with influenced you in any way politically within our city?
Within our city? I don't know. I find our city politics laughable. I don't think so. I mean, I'm not involved politically, except that I send money to the people I want to see elected.
May I ask a question? Your interest in World War II is evident. How did your parents respond to it? Did they have family still in Europe? Or?
My father, if he did, didn't know anything about it. They were such a large nuclear family. And they had a few cousins in Pittsburgh, as I said, the Jacobsons, and then another Azen cousin of my grandfather's came here. And they did not, whether they didn't remember or didn't know, I don't know, but they did not have, my father's family did not have family in Europe that they kept in touch with. My mother's family did leave relatives in Romania. And my man I call Uncle Sam Samuel, used to keep in touch with them, and then, of course, during the war, lost touch completely and had no idea what happened to them. He went to Romania after the war, of course not with the skills we have today, and he never found a trace of them. It would be interesting now to see, probably could find them if I could find someone who knew their names.
And the archives that are available today are different than they were a few years ago.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Just on a personal level, do you know where in Romania?
I can't remember the name. It was a garrison town, that's all I know, where Russian soldiers were stationed. And two of my mother's cousins fell in love with Russian soldiers and stayed there.
That's interesting. During the American Depression, you were very young. Did you feel any involvement as far as your family was concerned with depression, with problems of schooling and so on?
Not problems with schooling, because we were in public school. Maybe it was college age. In my family, now, I know my husband's sister had to leave school, but no, not in my family. I guess I was fortunate to be of public school age. I remember my father worrying terribly because he was in the retail business, and it was really, really difficult. And I can tell you can see how we were actually in a very good position. We lived on Bell Rock Place in a house that my parents bought because the former owner couldn't pay the mortgage, so they probably bought it very, very cheaply. But the worst, I remember the biggest fright of the due to the depression was when my father one night at dinner said things were so bad, if it didn't get any better, we'd have to sell the house and live above the store. And to me, that was just something I could not even imagine. And when I met Seymour and his family lived above the store, I couldn't believe it.
Now, subsequent to that, we had prohibition.
No,
were not of an age that it mattered.
No, I was born in 1927, and prohibition ended in 1933. So it didn't mean anything.
Were you involved in family way at all during the wars, other than Seymour's war experiences? Anybody else in your family?
Not family. I had a couple of close high school friends. And they all went off to war, but two were killed. And then one person that I really liked, I just talked about it the other night, and this was my cousin Sue Samuel's husband, was a twin. And the twin, I liked him very much. I mean, I was a little girl, but he was sort of my ideal. And he promised me that when he came back from the war, I'd be old enough and he'd take me out. And he was killed in the war. And we just talked about that with you all the other night.
Were you, I'm sure you were aware, you are aware, but have you had anything to do with things like the Civil Rights Movement? The Negro.
Oh, I was very active in this in the American Jewish community, all through those. I was very, very active. And as a matter of fact, I don't remember the years, but there were three of us that took on the responsibility of writing a policy statement regarding busing when busing first started.
Who were the people who did it? Was this while you were still in school?
No, this was the Civil Rights Movement, the 60s. I was very active. While I was going back to graduate school, I no longer had anything to do with the women's organizations. I couldn't do that because I was busy all day. But I was on the board of the American Jew, the Pittsburgh chapter of the American Jewish Committee, and I was very active in that. course, they were totally involved in the civil rights movement. And
could you elaborate on how they were involved?
It's very hard for me to remember that. But the American Jewish Committee was organized way back in 1906 to protect the rights.
1906?
06. In New York. Well, oh, Audrey, hi. Welcome.
Wow. Hi. We have people.
Yeah. You were talking about particular involvement with the civil rights movement.
Well, I know, I was talking about the American Jewish Committee. And it was organized by a group of wealthy New York leaders. And it was a committee, like six or eight men who started it. And they organized in order to protect the rights of Jews, immigrant Jews. And they worked very hard against establishing quotas for immigrants in the 1900s and 1910s. And in the 1910s, when the NAACP was organized, they helped organize it and worked. In other words, they were Americans first, and they were Jewish. And they felt that it was the obligation of Jews, American Jews, to protect the rights of all minorities. And that has been their policy since they were organized. And as they expanded and more people participated, that basic philosophy did not change. Although they were originally a very, very liberal, in quotes, group, became more conservative in the, I would guess, in the early in the 80s, as the country became more conservative. But they were still very, very involved in they've always been involved in intergroup relations, and I have also been involved in intergroup relations. And as a subgroup of the chapter here, I was part of a group that formed the Pittsburgh. I was part of a group that formed the Pittsburgh Ethnic Coalition, and this was with the backing of and the professional help of the professional at the American Jewish Committee. And the purpose was to organize a group of representatives of all of various ethnic organizations in the city to cooperate on when anything went on that would threaten anyone or any show of hostility or discrimination. And we worked very well together. Then it sort of they deorganized, and now they're active again, but I did not again become part of it, because by this time I was too involved with Jewish Residential Services.
Have you been interested or active in anything on the State of Israel?
Not really. Not beyond Federation and giving to Federation.
You've been very involved with your writings on the immigrant communities, mm-hmm. and
I am
history.
A historian. I have a PhD in history.
Would you like to go back to the beginnings when you first started doing that, and you were doing immigrants of a variety of peoples, not just Jewish?
Oh, well, I'll tell you a little bit about that. First of all, just to finish up on the Mexico thing, when it was time to write my dissertation, I had to find a topic, and I started to work on public education in Mexico, and I found that I was bored to tears with it. And I thought, well, what do I care enough about to put all this effort into? And I figured, I care about Jews. So I wrote my dissertation on the history of the Jews in independent Mexico from 1820 to the community that was formed by 1950. So that sort of closed out my chapter on research in Mexico, because I couldn't find a full-time tenured college position, which meant that I could not continue research in Mexico because I had no resources to pay for. So that's when I began to teach around various colleges. I taught at Chatham for a year, taught at Pitt in Greensburg for a year, taught at Carlo for a year, and I decided that I wasn't going to go around scrounging for jobs, that that wasn't my style, and that I would do research and writing that I could do in Pittsburgh. And many circumstances and influences of friends led me to, I also had a personal interest, because I had started out very traditionally. I was the child of very traditional parents. All they wanted of me was to marry a nice Jewish man, preferably a doctor. That was it. That their dreams for me were fulfilled the day I married Seymour. But my dreams for me weren't fulfilled. I didn't even have dreams, just developed. I was dissatisfied with just being a homemaker. As you can hear, I never was. I was always involved in something. But at any rate, after I had the PhD, but I couldn't get a job, I had the idea of doing oral histories of three generations of women, because I was wondering if other Jewish women, and then it expanded to other women of traditional backgrounds, had the same kind of conflicts that I did about moving from the traditional role to the professional role. And I don't know how I knew about it. I guess I knew about oral history from counsel, but I knew about oral history from history, a lot of what I had read.
Probably doing research, original research.
That's right. Even when I was in Mexico, I interviewed, people from who had come much, much earlier to Mexico City. At any rate, I developed, and this took a long time, I'm going to say it very quickly, the idea of examining tradition and change among women in three different ethnic groups, Jewish, Italian, and Slavic. And I was fortunate enough to interest the Falk Medical Fund in funding the research. I have to thank counsel for helping me to get my grant. I called Philip Hallen, who was the president of the fund in 1974.
How do you spell his last name?
H-A-L-L-E-N. And told him what I was planning to do, and asked him if I could come in to talk about a possible grant. And he said, "Oh, you don't understand, Dr. Krauss. We're a medical fund." And I said, "Well, I think I do understand. I once heard Mr. Falk say," and this is true because I went to interview Leon Falk with Miriam Wolfson for one of the very early National Council of Jewish Women interviews. And Mr. Falk was talking about his interest in the American Jewish community and its intergroup relations. And Miriam Wolfson asked him about that, and he said, "Well, we have a very interesting case. I want to be able to fund the Arab-Jewish dialogue in Israel and the Black Jewish relationships studies in the United States." And so we had our attorney go to court, and the judge agreed that prejudice is a mental disease. And so Mr. Hallen said, "Okay, come on in." And that was just fortuitous, just lucky that I'd been there that day. At any rate, it was. They had a lot of money in those days, in the 70s. The fund was prosperous. They were very into intergroup relations, and they wanted, this was a sort of a coup for the fund to research a women's project, because it was early for research stricken on women.
When did you start? What year did you start?
Well, this was 74 when I first started to talk, and then the year I had a lot of help. I had Mr. Hallin's help. I had David Fowler, professor at Carnegie Mellon, and he knew the person who was then the head of the Historical Society, and he took me to meet him. And he was interested, too, because this was the very beginning of the Historical Society starting to inch away from its traditional WASP Revolutionary War emphasis.
How were you able to select the people that you chose?
Oh, well, that was another story altogether. I found two people to help me. First of all, we have Slavic, Italian, Jewish. So the first thing I did, I called Duquesne University, and I talked to my friends there, and I said, I'm doing this project, and I would love an Italian woman scholar to help me. I need two other scholars to help find the people and to plan the questioning and to interpret, because we each see things from our own point of view and our own frame of reference. And he recommended Dr. Francesca Colecchia, C-O-L-E-C-C-I-A.
C-O-L-E-C-C-I-A.
Francesca. And she was thrilled. She was the head of the Spanish, actually the head of the Modern Language Department at Duquesne University. And she just was thrilled with the idea of doing something entirely different from the teaching and the politics of the university, and working with me and with other women. And she did a fantastic job. We also had, I don't know how I heard about it, but the third person came to be Bosanka, B-O-S-A-N-K-A.
B-O-S-A-N-K-A.
That's her first name. Mm-hmm. Ivosovic, E-V-O-S-E-V-I-C.
It's from the South Side.
Yes, and her mother had Sarah's Restaurant, the ethnic restaurant on the South Side. And Bosanka had been with the Board of Education in supervisory positions for several years. She knew people in every part of the city and from the Slavic community. So everybody helped recruit in different ways. And just people would give us ideas, and we had to be very careful, because we didn't want everybody the same. We wanted the women, the Jewish, Italian, and Slavic, middle generation. We couldn't do anything about making the immigrants the same. They were very different. But the middle generation, the women, sort of my generation.
The first generation Americans.
Not necessarily, because some of the grandmothers were born here. So, but the second generation of this age group. The immigrant, all three groups came in the major immigration wave from 1880 to 1950.
1880.
All three of these groups, 15, to World War I. And so the dates of immigration were similar for all three groups. And I forget what the ages were, but we tried to match by the education and occupation of the middle generation. And then, because in the younger generation, so we probably had an average group, average socioeconomically, of Jewish women, and a higher than average group of Italian and Slavic women, because they were the ones who were also, who were comparable. Half the women, they weren't, but if half the women, in half the Jewish women were secretaries, then half the Italian women were secretaries. So it was trying to match them socioeconomically.
And when was that book published?
Well, actually, it was a report published in 1977, a really full report, but not with complete stories. And then, just a few years ago, I had a letter from somebody who told me that the publisher was planning to do a series in oral history and thought they'd be interested. And so a book called Grandmothers, Mothers, and Daughters, I think, was published in
1990.
Still in print. I don't think so. Yeah. I don't think so. Although we have to get a paperback publisher to reprint it, because it was very well received in academic circles, used in women's history and women's literature.
But I have to check to see when it was printed.
You mean Grandmothers, Mothers, and Daughters? Well, I could check too. I'll check that for you.
What has evolved?